Okay. It's a bittersweet, sad day.
Yeah, we learned that Vic Fontaine is a regular character.
I was referring to the fact that we are now in the last season of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
And it's not the best season. These two episodes, I think, are quite good, and I like them a lot.
I really like them, yeah.
And I don't think that the last season is bad by any means, and I don't want to give that impression. But I'm sad because I love this show, and these are two really good episodes, and I'm going to miss it. I mean, I'm trying not to wish our life away because we still have, 12 more weeks of this, but it's coming to the end. And
yeah, it's very clear that in these two episodes specifically, it's clear that I assume they know, or they figure that this is going to be their last season. I mean, they're winding down slowly. Again, we have a whole season's worth of, but this is kind of finishing some of the final, starting to close some circles.
Yes, absolutely. And they did go into this knowing it was going to be the last season. Mm-hmm. TNG got 7 seasons. DS9 was going to get 7 seasons.
Voyager will get 7 as well, right?
Yes, and Enterprise is the one that was canceled after 4. So, and that was the end of Star Trek for many years. Well, not for many years, more for like 4 years, because then the movie came out 4 years later, which everyone was kind of like, what? But yeah, I think that, one of the things that was kind of, a stated goal with these two episodes, and I think this is going to be another week where we may not talk about them individually because they are really,
yeah,
not really a two-parter, because interestingly enough, I think, again, the show is, toying around with serialization. It's got a previously on, but it also doesn't ever say this is the conclusion. It does say this is the continuation, even though the next episode doesn't really follow up with the events of Shadows and Symbols too much. I mean, it's not like a direct follow-up to that. So they're really at this point kind of just laying down the gauntlet and saying, you know what, these are just ongoing storylines, and this last season is going to be, I don't want to give too much away, but the last, I think, 8 episodes of the season or 10 episodes of the season are pretty much like the first 6 episodes of the 6th season,
okay,
where it's all just kind of this one big story.
Which I assume will be the final push and the final ending of the war. Because at this point, obviously, we have 1 season left. It's possible they'll resolve the war around the middle, but the end. But that, again, maybe that last 8 to 10 arc where, and resolving the war and giving a glimpse of what the aftermath will be.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll find out about that. But
yeah.
And we have a lot of war stuff in these two episodes as well.
And I mean, they're connected in that Images in the Sand is very much setting up everything, getting everything to that tension spot. And this is then, everybody's the first episode ends before they're about to do a bunch of stuff.
Right.
And then the second episode is them doing the stuff. The second episode does end on a more resolved note. It's very obvious where some of these plots are going to go. We're obviously going to have some, Ezri Dax getting used to everybody and everybody getting used to her and all of those things. We're going to see Ben in his final stages of his enlightenment. We're going to see the end of the war. These are the obvious plots that it's going to start following up on, and there's a lot, but it also does feel like the end of a two-parter.
Yeah, in a way it does. And I think
the immediate stories are resolved.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot of changes in these episodes. And, we have the introduction of Ezri Dax. We have the revelation that Captain Sisko is part god. We have, in a minor way, Kira gets promoted, which was something that Nanav Visitor wanted. She kind of said, hey, everyone else has been promoted. Why not me? And they said, okay, that's a good idea. So she's a colonel now. And aside from that, I want to talk about Dax, I think, first. Because the first episode, Image in the Sand, is very small. It's a character piece, essentially. Yeah. And yes, stuff does go on with the war. And, we have the introduction of this character, Senator Kreetak, the Romulan presence on DS9. We have nice tensions between Admiral Ross and Colonel Kira, which I think they work really well together against each other. And I love their scenes because we haven't seen this side of Kira in a while. But I don't want to talk about her yet. I want to talk about Ezri because how do you feel about her as a character? And I know that you don't have much information or context for her yet.
But where they're taking her is, again, when Jadzia dies and Ben is saying, you know, you were my mentor and now you were my friend. And I was saying, you know, the next obvious stage is for this new incarnation of Dax to be Ben's protege. And I mean, this version of Dax is even younger than I expected. She's seems to be about Jake's age.
She's an ensign.
Yeah.
So it looks like she may just be out of the academy.
Yeah. She's like 20. I mean, Jadzia, when we saw her, was very late 20s. Yeah. Had been joined for a year or two at that point, was still kind of new to the role, but kind of at the same place as Ben was.
And I think it was always a little bit unclear whether or not Jadzia had attended the academy before she was joined. I think she must have been. Hmm. But that's, you know, neither here nor there, really.
Yeah. Either way, this is somebody who is not only less experienced in terms of rank, but who didn't even have the Trill joining training. And she says, I never even wanted to be joined. I mean, this is one of the rare Trills who apparently doesn't see being joined as a great honor. She's kind of, based on a few things, you know, she had her life. She had her career path. She was going to be a ship's counselor. You know, she had her friends. She had everything. And now just circumstances put her in this very weird position that nobody's really helping her. Well, Ben is the only person who Dax can trust, who knows a little bit about what it's like to be a Trill and can maybe...
Yeah.
Again, this version of Dax needs to start being able to handle her memories.
Yeah.
I wonder, that, by the way, if we're going to see... an episode, the thing that Dax goes through where her previous hosts appear. I wonder if we're going to see Ezri going through that, because that would be a very interesting way of having Jadzia appearing. But
we'll have to find
out.
I
don't know.
Yeah, I think that Ezri is an interesting character.
Yeah.
I think for a couple of reasons. You know, everything that you said is right, I think. And, you know, they wanted to have another female Dax, mostly because they didn't want Kira to be the only main cast member who's a woman. And I think that that's the right call. I mean, you know, some criticisms of Ezri are certainly that, okay, it's another white woman and she's very young and she's very pretty and
sure,
all that kind of stuff. And I understand those criticisms, and I think it would have been interesting if Ezri had been, you know, a different race or something, you know, just make her a little bit different. And they do try and make her different in that she didn't want to be joined.
Yeah.
She had no interest in being joined. It was forced upon her, which I think says, and it does say something about her that she agreed to do
it,
because of course she could have let Dax die. And I don't think that anybody would have really been,
that wouldn't have ended her career. Yeah.
Right. I mean, because, you know, Starfleet is not going to force someone to do something mm-hmm. like that against their will. We've seen that throughout, you know, TNG, for example. So I don't necessarily think that it says that she is wanting to be a joined Trill. She's very confused. I think that having her be a counselor is an interesting choice.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a show that we've talked a lot about the fact that there is no counselor. It's a very different type of environment. They probably need one.
Well,
now they have one, but she's kind of schizophrenic.
Well, she's not really able to, as she says, you know, she admits herself in this episode, she's not really good at being a counselor right now because she's understandably very scattered and confused. She's had barely 3 months to deal with an entirely different way of being, you know.
Yeah.
She even just orders a Ractigino by, you know, kind of instinct when she gets to replicator, which she hates. I mean, she doesn't know how to modulate all of these because she didn't have the training. And even Jadzia had moments, especially in the early seasons, where a certain host urges would take over a little more.
Well, and I think also that the interesting thing about Ezri is that if you look at the way Jadzia approached Ben, for example, you know, it was very much a warm introduction, but she did not presume that they were going to have a friendship or a relationship of any type. And I think that had a lot to do with the fact, of course, that Jadzia was prepared to be joined. And Ezri wasn't. And even in the last scene of Shadows and Symbols, when, you know, Jake and Sisko and Ezri come back to the station, and Ezri's just like, hey, Worf.
Yeah.
Hey, Kira. Hey, Odo. You know, like, she is presuming a level of intimacy that is not there.
Yeah.
And she would not do that if she was prepared to be joined. Because it seems to me that one of the things that the Trill Symbiosis Council helps joined Trill through is this idea that, yes, you have the memories of previous hosts. You even have a bit of the personality mm-hmm. of the previous host. But you don't know these people, and you have to
approach, or more importantly, they don't know you.
Right. And you have to approach that carefully, and you have to not presume a level of intimacy that is not there because you are a new person to them. And Esri doesn't have that. And so I think that that's going to be an interesting path for that character going forward.
I mean, I think part of that even just simply has to do with her age. The fact that, again, her friends and family are totally weirded out by her now. She's really looking for a friend, and these are people who the Dax part of her knows are going to be very warm to her. Even if there will be difficulties, she definitely knows that. But everybody on DS9 that Jadzia knew is going to approach her in good faith.
Right. And I mean, I think open questions are surrounding sort of, you know, what is Quark going to do?
Yeah.
What is Bashir going to do? What is Worf going to do?
Especially considering that Jake and Esri seem to click very well, and frankly
are... Which is interesting because Jadzia and Jake never really had much of a friendship. I mean, they liked each other, but...
But also, when we first saw...
Well, they're closer in age, too,
that's
now.
It. When the series begins, Jadzia's in her late 20s, Jake is a young teenager, so... Yeah, she's his friend's kid, and
she might be 2 years older than him.
Yeah, exactly.
Not much older than him, if that. And you know, maybe the last thing to say about Esri is that, you know, it, like you said, it is kind of setting it up to be sort of a mentor relationship with Ben Sisko mentoring Esri Dax, reversing how it worked before with Curzon. And I do think that it's an interesting choice for the show to have both of them be very, very confused. I mean, Sisko is hearing voices.
Yeah.
Sisko is having visions. Sisko is going through a, you know, serious religious awakening, religious crisis, and he is not in a position to mentor anyone, but he is open and willing to help out Esri, and Esri is willing and open to help out him. So I think they're going to be okay.
Well, yeah, Dax and Jadzia Dax and Ben worked well together. Anytime the two of them drew strength from each other during their various crises. And so I think Ben and Esri realizing that they aren't quite able to help each other through is kind of what, but we can try anyway. And at least they're getting some strength by struggling together. Even if they have their own things to deal with, they will still have that core and that solid foundation. I mean, this is the third version of Dax that Ben has
known.
Yeah, and so he's very easily, he's going to be very, it's going to be a lot easier for him than it will be for, say, Julian or Miles to make that click because he's done it twice before. I mean, Jake instantly seems to get who Esri Dax is.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the third time he's known a version of Dax his whole life.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, at least since he was 13 or 14 years old, which, you know, is a formative period in anyone's life.
Yeah.
And I also think it's interesting that, you know, Esri and Ben both meet each other for the first time when both of them are in leaves of absence as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's a minor thing, but I think it really does show that they're both in a place of crisis. And, you know, especially in Shadows and Symbols, I think that they help each other through that.
Yeah, and frankly, the fact that Ben is on a leave of absence probably does inspire Esri to, okay, well, I'm going to take one too and meet up with him. I can't. If Ben had still been on DS9, she wouldn't have asked for a leave of absence. She would have asked for a transfer.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see what happens with that. And then I guess. No, go ahead.
I really like the way the actress is playing her.
Yeah.
Because there are moments when you see a definite Esri. And that's the kind of the more panic moments. But then there are moments where Esri has, you know, clarity and calm. And then there are moments when Jadzia steps out. And I don't know, she's playing it very subtly. She does seem to have a handle a little quicker on what it means to have these, what is it, seven previous toasts bouncing around in there.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, they had a lot of trouble casting her. And the initial conception was that Esri was going to be another a trill that was prepared to be joined.
Yeah.
And then they kind of hit upon this idea. I think it was, I forget who it was, if it was Ira Stephen Bear, if it was Bemler or someone else. But, you know, essentially they said, let's have someone who didn't want to be joined and wasn't prepared for it. And suddenly this was like, oh, great. She'll be hearing voices and she'll be confused. And
yeah,
it will be sort of this existential crisis for this character. And we will be able to do something different and make her distinct.
Yeah.
And
I was originally wondering if they were going to make the new Dax actually be the one that interned for Jadzia for a little while, mirroring the how Jadzia washed out but then reapplied herself. Maybe he was going through the same thing and Jadzia had requested him. But again, this is I think this is a very interesting direction. This is seeded a lot more.
Yeah.
And this actually makes Ezri Dax a very different character, because if it were somebody who was the same age as Jadzia when we met her first, and it would be the same exact thing. That would be, frankly, a gratuitous killing off Jadzia in order to just replace her with herself.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I do think maybe the last thing to say about Ezri before I move on to something else is that in one sense, you could read this as the safe choice, you know, in bringing back Dax as a main character. You could have seen a version of this where Dax shows up for an episode or two and is not a main character. And instead, for example, Kreetak is a main character in the seventh season. You know, they could have done something like that. I don't know that there's so much else going on.
That Romulan senator?
Yeah.
Okay. See, I thought she was going to be a main character and then shifty things started happening.
Right.
But we'll talk about her.
We'll talk about her. But I think that would have been, if you want to have another woman in the main cast, I think.
Yeah.
And I think it would have been interesting to have a Romulan as a main cast member. But, you know, it's fine that it's Ezri. I think that thematically it works. And I think that they're going, I mean, especially in these first two episodes, like we've talked about, I think that with Sisko having this crisis of faith and Ezri also having this crisis of conscience and being very confused, I think it's going to work well. And it's also going to create some dramatic tension, of course, because, again, this is no surprise that Bashir will have to deal with this.
Yes.
That Worf will have to deal with this. And maybe it's
She ends the episode saying, you know, Worf, we have to talk.
Right.
And
that's the thing is so that's a good opportunity maybe for us to segue over into the glorious battle to get Jadzia into Stovokor, because I'm not a fan of the revelation and change of heart that Bashir and Quark are secretly still in love with Jadzia. I'm like, why do we have to go back to this? Especially Quark, which is just kind of there was never any indication of that. So I kind of like the idea that Worf is, I mean, the show is really baldly facing Worf's grief. And, you know, it really is. I like the fact that everyone is still struggling with this 3 months later.
Yeah.
And
because 3 months, especially in wartime, well, 3 months in war is probably a very long time, but in real time, it's not that much.
It's not that much. And, you know, Vic Fontaine, whatever you think about him, and it doesn't sound like you're a fan of him, but okay, that's fine.
We're getting diminishing returns.
I like Vic Fontaine. I don't know. But, and, you know, he'll be around more, so you better wise up with that. But I like this idea that Worf goes to Vic Fontaine's lounge to fuck it up. he's dealing with his grief in a very Klingon way. I also like the fact that Martok is they engineered this thing about Martok helping him to get, you know, Jadzia into Stovokor.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's much to talk about, but I think it's interesting that Worf is so insistent that Jadzia is getting into Stovokor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's never really any indication that Jadzia Dax is getting into Stovokor. I don't know.
No, and they all make it, they all say Jadzia very pointedly. I think they kind of avoid that question. But
yeah, because it raises the question in my mind, it's a question I want to ask you, is how much do you actually think Worf understands or has internalized the fact that Jadzia Dax was his wife and not Jadzia? Because he wants to get Jadzia into Stovokor. And now he has to deal with Dax being back, and we'll see what happens with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I can really see Worf as someone who he seems to be ignoring the fact that Jadzia Dax is still alive in some way.
Well, alive and not alive. I guess we have to go back to the Rakta Geno scene, because the Dax part likes It's said to come from Curzon. That's passed to the Dax symbiote, who passes it on to Jadzia. But that's part that's still in the Dax symbiote, but that Ezri Dax so doesn't like that, you know, she's able to kind of overwrite it in that, in that situation. So the Klingon-ness, in a way, may be very similar. In other words, Curzon hung out with Klingons all the time. That's passed to the Dax symbiote. Jadzia ends up picking it up. And, I mean, to say that Jadzia, again, Jadzia and Dax, it's not an even half and half, but for the purposes of this conversation, let's pretend there's a Jadzia half and a Dax half. I certainly believe that the Jadzia half loved Klingon stuff and loved Worf, and so...
Oh, sure.
You know, whether or, you know, we're getting into the state of the soul in a lot of ways, but... I don't know. Worf still was married to Jadzia, and I don't know what his views towards Ezri Dax are going to be.
Right.
I frankly don't know if Worf is going to be interested in a tiny 20-year-old, ensign, really.
I would doubt it.
Yeah, exactly. That, you know,
I mean, he was attracted to Jadzia, you know, well, primarily because it seems like they had hot sex, but also, yeah,
but that's it. Like
she was strong, and he felt that she was a warrior, and
yeah,
she had a good spirit, and you know, all that kind of stuff. And you know, Ezri is not that.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem to be anyway. And also, I think too that there is this idea. I mean, it's a nice threading throughout these two episodes. You know, this episode deals very baldly with religion and religious faith and mm-hmm. faith and crisis of conscience and things like that. You know, they do talk about Bashir and Miles. I mean, I'm not really sure why he's there. He's there because he's supporting Bashir, but Worf seems to think that. It's weird because they have that scene where Worf is apologizing to Quark and Bashir and O'Brien, which is a nice scene.
Yeah, yeah.
But he also sort of is like, yeah, he would say things about Quark and she would say things about Quark and she would say things about Bashir and she would say things that all of you said. And like, I don't really think she ever talked about O'Brien. So nice.
Maybe
way to elide it, you know, but.
Yeah, but O'Brien seems to be there because Bashir is there, and otherwise they couldn't slot him into any of the other plots.
Right, exactly. And you know, he's been on Klingon missions before, so why not? But what I'm really getting at is this idea, you know, they really do leave it open. I mean, you know, Worf obviously is a spiritual person and believes in Klingon mythology and Klingon religion and really does believe mm-hmm. that Jadzia is going to go to Stovokor and that this is what is going to happen. Her soul is going to Klingon heaven. Bashir, Quark, and O'Brien, they don't really seem to believe that. I think that this is a way for them to honor Jadzia's memory more than anything else and to show to Worf that she was loved by a lot of other people, not just Worf, and to help him through his grief.
Yes, this is more of a due to the living in some ways than a due to the dead.
Yeah,
for them.
Yeah,
but you know, yes, they're taking Stovokor as a metaphor, but this is pretty emblematic of everything, and frankly, Jadzia's own views, which she was starting to work through right before she died.
Yeah.
That are they wormhole aliens or are they prophets? Is this a thing we're doing to show Worf and to honor and to kind of make our mark, or is literally the soul of Jadzia going into Stovokor? The show doesn't, but again, here the show kind of allows both to exist, allows both to be equally important and meaningful, doesn't really care what's really going on long as, you know, what matters is the act and what matters is the relationships between the people.
Yeah, I think so, and I think it's a nice storyline for them.
Yes,
and also they get to destroy a Dominion shipyard. That, so that's always good.
That whole sequence was awesome.
Yeah, it was good. Well, and I think also, you know, maybe it's a good opportunity for us to transition over to talking about the Bajoran religion because this is a very important episode for a lot of reasons. I like the fact that the show has really gone down a road of respecting the Bajoran religion and respecting the Bajoran faith, while at the same time really leaving the question open, you know, are these just energy being wormhole aliens that are, you know, they care about Bajor for some reason?
Yeah.
They're being worshipped as gods. Are they actually gods? I mean, it's an open question, but I think really what it comes down to is that that's not really the issue. The issue is, do you have faith in them or not? And mm-hmm. the show is really grappling at this point with questions of faith and questions of what does all of this mean? Is there a path for me? What is my destiny? And I applaud the show for dealing with this because this is not something that Star Trek generally deals with or deals with very well. And
I'm thinking of the way, you know, the original series did, you know, God beings, which was always ridiculous and, you know, most egregiously in Star Trek V.
Yes. Yeah.
That dealt with the ambiguity between God and an energy being and just shit the bed on that.
Right.
This allows the wormhole aliens or the prophets or whatever these beings are to be a both physical and spiritual entities, because they do explicitly have both properties.
Yes, absolutely. And there's also a lot of, I mean, one of the things about, you know, God, the question of God, does God exist, all these kind of things, is that there's a mystery to it and that these are unknowable questions. These are, the answers are unknowable to a certain sense. And that really is what faith is. You just believe that there is an answer, that this is makes sense. And that is really what it comes down to with the prophets as well. And, you know, I want to talk about specifically, I mean, so I was watching, when I watched Symbols and Shadows, and, you know, Sisko was having the false vision from the Pah Wraith, right?
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about that because it's very interesting, but
it's meta as shit.
It is. Here's my I have a crazy theory that I came up with while I was watching this episode.
I'm so excited for this. He's been teasing this to me all day.
So I wanted to rewatch Emissary, but I didn't have time. Mm-hmm. And if you think back to the first episode of the show, the reason why Sisko finds the wormhole is because Kaio Paka tells him that it is his destiny to find the Celestial Temple. And so Sisko and Dax go looking for it, and they find it. Now, we know that Kaio Paka was a Kai of great faith. We know that she did speak to the prophets. We know that she had visions. And it seems likely to me that the prophets told her in a vision that Sisko was the emissary, and that Sisko, essentially what I'm saying is the prophets were acting through Kaio Paka to have Sisko, to drive Sisko to fulfill his initial destiny of finding the Celestial Temple / wormhole.
Yeah, she is the archetypal wise woman, and she gets told by God that that's her role in this entire series.
Exactly.
Sure.
And so this is a little bit of a retcon because you're fitting in things from the original conception of the show, which of course was quite different. But essentially what I'm getting at is that it seems very likely to me that the prophets have put all of the events of the show into motion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my theory.
Yeah.
That the prophet, I mean, the revelation that Sisko is part prophet or part God, the revelation that they essentially created Sisko because he had to be created. I mean, it's a closed circle. It's a tautology, but that is what religion and faith are to some degree.
Yeah. Well, you can continue because I do have some questions on that, but I don't want to kill your momentum.
But I think that if you look at the false vision that the Pah Wraith is giving to Sisko, in a way, you know, if you say, okay, the prophets created Sisko, they needed Sisko to be the emissary for whatever reason. We don't know what that reason is. They one of the prophets left the Celestial Temple / wormhole to go to Earth and inhabit the body of this woman, Sarah, who married Sisko's father, and they had a child. Sisko is part prophet or whatever, and he is the emissary, and they created him because they needed him to exist. Yeah. And they needed him to exist so that he could be the one, they could be the one to drive him to create all the events of the series. And at the same time, the vision that Sisko has in this episode, the false vision from the Pah Wraith, from the Costimogen, is the story of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that, I mean, that's part of the theory, but also the other half of that theory is that both the prophets and the Pah Wraiths want the events of Deep Space Nine to happen for some reason, but they seem to want them to happen for different reasons. And I guess the open question at this point is why?
Well,
so that's my theory.
Okay. Where to start with this? Because yes, I could definitely see a lot of this. What I found fascinating about this episode was the, now again, I don't know where the series is going to go or where it's going to end, but a lot of red flags went up, you know, at saying, oh, that's the false vision, you know, was you in the asylum. Because, as we said, in reality, quote, and reality is closer to Ben Russell's story than it is to Ben Sisko's story, right? There are,
yeah, I mean,
you know, there are very obvious examples.
I love Star Trek, but Star Trek is not reality.
Yes, and while Ben Russell himself is not an actual character, there were plenty of, you know, examples historically of black men who were, you know, put in asylums,
sure,
to, you know, or
sure,
prison or whatever. And in a way, this does come from, this is a fictional story that is written with the same spirit that Ben Russell is writing. And the bigger victory is of Ben Russell refusing to paint over his story more so than it is Ben Sisko opening the box.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. Again, I think it's possible that the series could simply end with, you know, 20 years later, and this is Jake. Oh, I wrote my book about Deep Space Nine and my experiences. But it can just as easily end with Ben Russell getting out of the asylum and publishing his own book.
Yeah, and I think we did mention it, Far Beyond the Stars, that that was one of the ideas,
yeah,
in the series, and they decided not to do that. So that's not going to happen. Yeah. But yeah, I think you're right, and I think that what that really comes down to for me is that, you know, the open question for me is, why do the prophets want all this to happen?
Yeah.
And I understand why the Pah Wraiths want it to happen, because if the events of Deep Space Nine were not put into motion by Kai Opaka acting, by the prophets acting through Kai Opaka to tell Sisko to find the Celestial Temple, the Pah Wraiths would never have been released. And the Pah Wraiths at this point, that was the key moment for them, when Ben Sisko was looking for the Orb of the Prophets and the Costamogen was giving him the false vision to stop him, and to keep the wormhole closed. So that makes sense to me, that would be the pivotal moment when the Pah Wraiths want this story to stop, essentially.
Yeah.
And essentially to keep Sisko in a false vision that he is actually a science fiction writer living in New York City in the 1950s who is in an asylum.
Yeah, they want him to paint over the wall, go back to his girlfriend, and run the diner.
Right, and Ben Sisko would be sent to, the actual Ben Sisko would be sent to some sort of, you know, convalescent facility on Earth, and he would be drooling or something. I mean, he would not be, you know, he'd be living in his fantasy world, he would never escape.
Yeah.
And that would be bad, of course, because they need the emissary. The prophets need the emissary, so the Pah Wraiths would win. So that's the one half of it, and I get that. I mean, and, you know, maybe we'll see exactly why this is happening. I don't know, but it seems to me that There's a missing piece here, which is that the prophets want all this stuff to happen
because
for some
reason. They want to cast out the Pah Wraiths once and for all. I think.
Yeah,
The reckoning, is it called? What is it called in the they want the reckoning to happen because that can be the final defeat of the Pah Wraiths, and as Kai Winn says, the golden age of Bajor. I mean, the prophets, whether or not they're gods or they're just energy beings who have an interest in Bajor, you can see why they would want that outcome.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought Kai Winn up as well, because, of course,
yeah,
what the fuck is going on with her, especially in The Reckoning? Like, here we have a Kai. You know, Kai Opaka was very pious. Kai Opaka had a great deal of faith. She had visions. The prophets spoke to her. Maybe not a lot, but they did. Kai Winn has openly said that the prophets have never spoken to her. She's never had an orb experience. She's never had a vision.
And her concerns are a lot more worldly. She's worried about, again, I
don't doubt her faith, but...
And her compassion for the people, I don't doubt either. She also likes herself a lot.
But we are, she does like herself a lot. And also we are dealing with a reality in which there are, you know, devils and gods floating around. And so... I don't know. What's going on there with her?
Hmm.
And could it be that the Pah Wraiths are working through her? I mean, there is a that is a possibility, I think.
Well, I think one of the things this episode kind of suggests is that, and this was something, I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast or just to you, that my belief is that the Pah Wraiths and the prophets are the same species, basically.
Yeah.
And the fact that the prophet who takes over Sisko's mother, essentially for the entire romance with Pa Sisko and giving a child, she was dealing with a version of what Keiko went through in that one. Now, probably it wasn't as horrifying to Keiko, horrifying to Sarah as it was to Keiko, but at the same time, she is watching while her body has sex with a man she doesn't really know and delivering a child. And as Ben says, no wonder she ran away.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think essentially she was, I mean, well, she was violated.
Yeah.
You know, and that also, I'm glad you brought that up, because that does raise the question of, okay, the prophets are,
yeah,
quote unquote, the good guys here, but.
Which is why when that's the person who's telling me, oh, that's a false vision from the evil paw wraiths, I can't necessarily condone that either. You know, this is, so I don't know. And again, it's unclear why Sisko, whether it's just a causality argument, whether there is, I don't know, something even genetic from both, you know, the Sisko line, yeah, and whatever Sarah's. I don't know if genetic predeterminism is something that the series believes in, but well, I'm just spitballing here.
Yeah, but I think the other part of that question is, what does it mean for a vision to be false?
Hmm.
Because the events of Far Beyond the Stars, the vision that Sisko has, yeah, in that episode is false.
Yeah.
It is not reality. But is it that the vision is supposed to get you somewhere that you should get to? Mm. And what makes the vision true or false is not the vision itself, but where it takes you.
Yeah, it's maybe false isn't the right word, but misleading, maybe distracting.
Mm-hmm.
That's a trap vision, something along those lines. Maybe is a bit more,
yeah,
accurate of a term, I guess.
And I think, you know, the other part of this, of course, that we've touched upon as well is that, and this is a question for you, is,
yay,
this is making the prophets out to be pretty dark, I think.
Yeah.
And what does that mean?
I mean, that's well within the realm of the series, is taking things that we assume are going to be 100% benevolent all the time and showing that there are darker underbellies in, you know, in a world that has, number one, devils and gods running around, and that also has Cardassians and Jem'Hadar running around.
Yeah.
Sometimes, again, war makes you get a little dirty. Section 31, we're going to see more of them, right?
Maybe.
Okay, because they made such a big deal of that in that episode, and we haven't seen anything them.
That's it. You never see them again. No, and I, you know, the other thing that makes me think, too, of course, is that one of the things that I always mention about Star Trek is that this is a series that believes in taking people at face value, mm, and believes in the good faith efforts of people to work together, and really does believe that everybody can come to some sort of common understanding and trust. You know, the Federation's default setting is trust. And this is queering that to a degree, because the prophets are not acting in good faith anymore.
Yeah.
Now, I don't necessarily know that their motivations are quote unquote bad, but...
Well, it's another version of... It's a lot of this series has been taking that phrase from Star Trek II, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, and really testing that in so many different ways. What did the prophets do in this situation? They possessed one woman, she had a relationship with one man and left him, and then one son grew up without his real mother. That's really three people who were affected by this.
Yeah.
You know, if we're saying the needs of the many, the entirety of Bajor going into a golden age, outweigh the needs of the few, these three people. Can we say that? I guess this series is, and I don't have an answer for that. Fortunately, you know, I don't, but the series is making clear that these questions need to be asked. You,
yeah,
can't just necessarily make Star Trek, the original series, and Wrath of Khan and all of that made that moral calculus blithely, right?
Yeah.
And even as soon as Star Trek III, they were starting to question that, whether that's a valid whether that's a valid motto to live your life by. But at this point, they're making it very clear, these cold equations of, you know, moral relativism and, you know, putting stuff on a scale. You can't necessarily, you know, is it violating the human cost in order to, you know, what line do you cross?
Well, I guess for them, the line is creating a human that's part, yeah, of the prophet in order to fulfill the destiny of whatever they want to do.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we did kind of elide over the fact, of course, that Sisko's entire birth and life was constructed by the prophets.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? Does that make sense to you? That's a pretty big change, I think.
Yeah.
In not the show necessarily, but in the experience of the character of Sisko.
Well, yeah. It's a... again, the Bajoran religion picks and chooses from a bunch of real Earth religions and some stuff of its own invention. But this is very much an annunciation type of story. This is a, you know, if Sisko is a messiah, this is another twist on the general virgin birth storyline. Again, one that's a lot darker, one that's taking, you know, one that kind of flips the genders a little bit around and again makes the mother not an entirely willing participant in this, but again, I think it's just darkening the typical messiah plot. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. at the same time, would Sisko have made any different decisions had, you know what I mean? Like, was joining Starfleet and getting to this position that he was, you know, did the prophets make it so that Jennifer died at Wolf 359 so that way Sisko would, you know, get into the position of DS9? You know, to what degree do the prophets have a hand in anything, or do they just nudge and let everything happen normally? And I don't know if the series is going to answer that question, but it's also one that we as people, you know, everybody who has religion has to deal with fate versus free will.
Yeah.
At some point. Yeah. And this is because one of the benefits of a science fictional narrative, especially one that dips so much into mysticism as this show is, can have an answer to these questions or can give these twists to these. And I mean, that's one of the reasons I love science fiction, because it is able to ask these very philosophical questions in a very weird way. It's a thought experiment in a way.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, what that makes me think of is your question about would Sisko have made any different choices in his life? I don't necessarily think so. The open question for me at the end of this is, the prophets have always made a big deal throughout the series of not actually acting in events. Mm. And Sisko has been the one to convince them to do things, specifically to disappear the Jem'Hadar fleet at the end of the fifth season or the beginning of the sixth season, whenever that was. And so, but now we have this revelation that they did act and they actually created Sisko, the emissary. Did they see the events playing out in a different way and they wanted to change it and they decided to create the emissary? Did they see the events of this playing out and decide that they needed to have somebody that was going to do it?
We don't know what degree to which the prophets are independent entities but you know, the Sarah prophet, if they are, you know, distinct entities, did the Sarah prophet act without the kind of agreement of everybody else? Did she just go rogue and decide this is what's happening?
Right.
I mean, that's a possibility too. Is the Sarah prophet really just the Costologian under a different disguise? You know, it's one false vision didn't work, so it immediately comes up with a very different false vision. I mean, it could be an entirely a lie.
It could be. I mean, I kind of err on the side of believing that, of course, because the show isn't that dark.
No.
But I mean, and also the other question too is who is that prophet flying out of the orb of the emissary?
Yeah.
Like, what the hell was that guy doing in there?
Yeah.
You know, like, we don't know.
Is that Sarah prophet?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was buried on this planet Tyree, which just kind of was dropped in there. Like, we should know what this planet was. But I always thought that was kind of weird. I was like, did we hear about this planet before? No, we never did. I don't know who that prophet is. I don't think it is Sarah, because Sarah was left by the prophet, you know, when Ben Sisko was two.
Yeah, so, but then she could have gone to bury the orb of the emissary and stayed in there. I don't know.
It's true. It's possible. I don't know that we'll get an answer to that question. But yeah, it's hard to answer at this point, and I think that it's probably better for us to move on to talk about something else.
Yeah, because there are right now. We're speculating on questions that kind of, you know, many of the answers to, I would assume, and that the rest are unanswerable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about, do you want to talk about Kira and the whole blockade with the Romulan? Do you want to talk about what's going on Cardassia? I think those are the two big things that we have left to talk about.
Cardassia is a little less interesting, but Damar is going to do something really interesting, isn't he? Like, he's actually going to, I'm waiting for him to do something, but...
it's possible.
he's really starting to, number one, he's drinking a hell of a lot.
Yeah.
But he's also starting to get a little decadent. Again, he meets this woman at this party and he's going, you know, and whether or not she's a spy, obviously Wei-Yun seems to account for that possibility in a way that Damar isn't. I assume she is just a random, Cardassian woman who was at the party that's, you know.
Damar wants to get his cloaca wet.
Well, yeah. Ew. But, yeah, no, he's enjoying the perks of his position, and he really doesn't give a shit about the war. He's only kind of doing that because Wei-Yun is forcing him to, I think, at this point.
The funny thing is, though, I kind of agree with you that Damar doesn't really care about the war. He cares about being in power.
Yes.
But also that he's just kind of casually good at it.
Now that
he seems better at it than Dukat ever was, certainly.
Well, now that Dukat's not out of the way, you know, now that Dukat's out of the way, Damar is starting to come into his own a little bit. I think the grandest strategies are being handled by Wei-Yun, and Damar is just doing the details, sure, which. Sure. Based on his relationship with Dukat, he was a very good lackey in a lot of ways. So yeah. He is kind of doing lackey work on this. But
I also think the other question about Damar, of course, is that, you know, he and Wei-Yun don't like each
yes.
other. So, you know, how much of this activity that Damar is engaging in, the drinking and the bringing in women into the command center and things like that and just kind of needling Wei-Yun,
yeah.
How much of that is just designed to annoy Wei-Yun and how much of that is actually Damar losing a little bit of control? I don't know.
I think it's just, again, one of those situations in which Damar has a predilection towards enjoying himself and he's in a stressful situation, so he's drinking, and it also pisses off the guy that is stressing him out the most. Mm-hmm. So this is, it's kind of a perfect storm.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have as much of a focus. Dukat had that laser sharp focus on, I want to take Bajor back. And as long as the goals of the war aligned with that, he was very good at his stuff. He only went off the deep end when that stopped, those were cross purposes.
Right, right.
His obsession with Bajor turned out to be part of his undoing, but Damar doesn't have, he just happened to be there. Damar really seemed to like Dukat and seemed to really want to work for Dukat, but now that yeah. Dukat is gone, what's he really doing? He's just kind of, he's the one in power, so he's doing what his job is because it's put in front of him, but he's the kind of person who goes home at the end of the day and, you know, he wants his beer and his woman.
Yes. And also, too, I think that Damar, to a large degree, you know, feels like this is, to some degree, isn't really his war.
Yeah.
You know, this is the Dominion War. If they lose it, well, Cardassian, you know, will be screwed, but the Dominion will be even more screwed. And so...
Yeah. The worst case scenario is Damar has to, you know, go on his hands and knees to the Federation and ask to be put into a cushy Federation prison. That is Damar's worst case scenario. Best case scenario is the Dominion wins, has Cardassia as its capital, and then he's got, again, all the Kanar he wants.
Right. I mean, I think that's a good point, actually, because if you're going to lose a war to anyone, I think that losing a war to the Federation is probably your best option, because the Federation is not going to be vindictive.
No, they're going to send all of their industrial replicators to help you rebuild your cities. They're going to send the best medical personnel in the galaxy.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess the Kira stuff is the final kind of arc of the episode to talk about. And
well, it speaks to me because, you know, we haven't seen this side of Kira in a while.
Yeah.
And I love this side of Kira.
Yeah.
This is the woman who was forged in the fires of the resistance coming out again. And the Romulan Kreatak doesn't know what the fuck she's getting into.
It's interesting. As a major, sometimes, you know, as a major, Kira was put above the fray, and she got kind of, she would get bored and restless at times because she was in an office position. Now as colonel, she's kind of gone. She's ascended to a position where she can be back in the fray as the one leading everything. And again, this is her. This is where she works the best. This is where she is 100% in control.
Well, the one thing that we know about Kira from throughout the entire series is that she works best under pressure.
Yeah.
And this is some serious pressure. I also think that there is a degree to which Kira has learned to trust people, mm-hmm. and she feels personally betrayed by Kreatak. Now, you know, there is that great line that Wei-Yun has, you know, it says the Romulans. so predictably treacherous. You know, and it's like, yes, of course you would see that this would happen. And Kreetak, you know, putting on a, well, whether or not it's a good act, whether or not she's sincere, we'll leave that open as an exercise for the listener. But
I do think in some ways, like when she's trying the Jumja stick and the parts that, I mean, it's a little sad because I think in a different situation, Kira and Kreetak would have become friends. And
yeah,
in the first episode, they seem to have these moments of, you know, connection. And if Kreetak were working in good faith, and maybe these missiles really are just genuinely for the defense of, you know, the hospital, and they're not going to be, but...
And that's the thing, though, of course, is that
it sounds like bullshit when I'm saying it, number one.
Right, because you don't need 3,000 photon torpedoes or whatever the fuck it is to defend a hospital. I think that, and the hospital also obviously was a transparent ploy to get the weapons there.
Yeah.
I don't think that they really needed the hospital. But it is sad because the Federation has essentially made its bed with the Romulans. The Romulans are not trustworthy. The Romulans are one of the only species in Star Trek that I think are completely non-trustworthy and have completely shown themselves to be non-trustworthy over and over and over again, which is sad, but that's the way that this is going, so we have to accept it because it's the reality of how they're portrayed in the series. But Bajor doesn't have a lot of direct experience with the Bajorans, mm-hmm. and I think that Kira has learned...
With the Romulans, sorry.
And she also has learned to trust other people. She learned from the Federation's example, and she wants to trust Kreetak. She wants to trust that this hospital is true, and she wants to help them. The sad part of it, of course, is that it doesn't seem like Kreetak is that interested in this either. I think that she's in an untenable position. Now, of course, the other wrinkle in this is that Kreetak is a senator, so she is in a position of power in the civilian government on Romulus, so she probably had some say in this.
Yeah.
The whole thing is just very messy, which I guess is what this show does best, but...
Yeah, I mean, Kira went through those, we've talked about this time and again, how she could understand that there were good Cardassians, and so she's at this point, learned very much that there can be good Romulans, and I guess her initial seeing Kreetak makes her think, oh, maybe she is one of the good Romulans. The second she realizes that something is fishy, she understands exactly, and the thing is that Kira gets her, it's really up to Admiral Ross, right? He's the one who's with Kreetak, he's the one who's initially suggesting to Kira that what she's doing is an overreaction, but he's trying to keep the peace. But it's very clear that whoever he says, you know, all right, stand down, has to, because then you have the might of the Federation on their side. They're really courting the Federation vote. And I think Kira knows more than anything that she can trust the Federation to do the right thing, because she knows that the Federation knows what bullshit this is too.
Yes. I mean, I think that that's true, but I think the relationship between Admiral Ross and Kira is legitimately contentious.
Yes.
You know, I don't think they like each other very much, and which is good. I mean, I'm happy when characters on Deep Space Nine don't like each other, because it's just different. But not that they're like enemies or anything, but I just think they rub each other the wrong way. And I think that Kira, I get the impression from Kira that the Federation is sort of running roughshod over Bajor in this instance.
Yeah.
And she already wasn't happy that the Federation made this unilateral decision to allow the Romulans to have a base of operations on DS9. And now she went out and made the olive branch and told Kreetak that she would go to the Council of Ministers and ask them to put this hospital on Durnum. And of course the Romulans, again, predictably treacherous, put the weapons on Durnum and put these events into control. And it spiraled out of control. And I think that, you know, Admiral Ross is walking a fine line here. Kira is, in a sense, rolling the dice, and she has a lot of pride with Bajor as well, because she wants Bajor to be strong.
Yeah.
She is a woman of faith. Let's think about the events of Bajala. The Bajala episode where, you know, Sisko essentially ran into the room right before they were about to sign the treaty, putting Bajor into the Federation. Was like, don't do it. And, you know, so I think that she wants to not needle the Federation, but I think she wants to show the Federation that Bajor is not just going to listen to them
yeah.
willy-nilly for no reason.
No, if Bajor, whether or not Bajor is going to join the Federation, and I assume that even if that's not covered in the series, it eventually will become part of the Federation. It doesn't want to be a tiny thing. It doesn't want right. to be a tiny nothing. It's either on its own terms as an equal or not.
Because the one thing is that Kira and Bajor do have a lot of pride, and they yeah. do have a lot to prove, and they have come a long way from the occupation, but, you know, they really still don't have much of a fleet. You know,
yeah.
the only ships that they can send are like these 12 small impulse ships that can't even travel at warp. You know, it's all very...
But, you know, there's also the timing of when the wormhole opens, you know, we can't ignore that
yeah.
because Kira is almost unsure, and then she sees that, takes it as the sign that God is on her side, and... I mean, that has to figure in Ross's and Kreetak's conversation. Like, even if they aren't believing it as a sign, Ross is going to point out that the Bajorans will, and they are going to fight. And if that Bajoran fleet is destroyed, because at this point they are going to sacrifice themselves for their profits, there's going to be a lot of problems with this alliance. And frankly, the Romulans, as far as the Dominions is concerned, have cast their lot in with the Federation and so are not going to be able to back out of that.
I think that's true. I mean, because the one question I did want to ask you is, you know, do you think Kira is right to jeopardize the alliance or not? And
I think she understands the importance of it. I mean, as much as she and Ross disagree on a lot of things, they are both very much on the same side of we want to beat the Dominion.
Yeah.
And Kreetak and the Romulans want to beat the Dominion too, frankly.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that there is really no way for the Romulans to back out at this
yeah.
point. I mean, they could try,
but
I don't think the Dominion would want to listen to them. I mean, once you open hostilities with the Dominion will crush you. And
yeah.
it doesn't matter if you want to make peace or not. I mean,
exactly.
I think the only way that the Romulan Empire could back out of the war and make peace with the Dominion is if they agreed to become part of the Dominion.
Yeah.
And the Romulan Empire is never going to agree to that.
That's
probably in Kira's calculus as well.
Yeah. And this does put the events of In the Pale Moonlight into another light because of how fragile this alliance already is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the dark shit
yeah.
that Sisko had to do in that turned out to be... You know, that didn't guarantee anything, and it certainly hasn't won the war already.
Right.
It gave them a major advantage, but it's one that's very tenuous, and that's not meaning everything.
Yeah, I think so.
So,
and I guess the last thing to mention before we wrap this episode up is maybe my memories are playing tricks on you, but have you gotten stranger? I just love that line.
Yeah. That's I think why I like her. I mean that's a very Jadzia moment.
Yeah, it is. It is. She's you know she has her problems as a character. But
yeah.
She's you know the
I mean
thing,
the
sad thing about Ezri is that we don't get a lot of
yeah.
to know her, of course, because she's introduced in the last season of the show, and there's a lot of other stuff to wrap up. So
that's what I was about to say. When she's you know I didn't quite like Terry Farrell / Jadzia Dax at first, but she very much warmed up to me and became one of my favorite characters. While I like Ezri, I know that she doesn't have 6 seasons to develop. And,
yeah.
you know, who we're seeing her now is probably who she's going to be for the rest of the time.
We'll find out.
Well, and there's also the novels, right?
Of course there are. And you can read all of them once we're done with DS9.
Yay!
Well, if you have any thoughts on either of the episodes we just discussed, please leave a comment on the post for this episode of the podcast at trekaboutshow.com. You can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/trekaboutshow. It supports us monetarily, and if you give us $5 a month or more, you will get a special patrons-only episode at the beginning of every month. And the one that we released a couple weeks ago for December was on Doctor Who for some reason.
What?
So that's good.
Oh, God.
Hey, it was your idea.
I know. Why did I have an idea to watch Doctor Who?
And, of course, the Patreon also supports our other podcast, Tuning In. We are starting the second season of United States of Terror this week.
Mm.
So it's a good time to jump into the show and listen to the podcast.
Yay.
We're on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our username is TrekAboutShow. And as always, please leave us an iTunes review for TrekAbout. It is helpful and makes us feel wonderful. Next week, we're continuing with the 7th season of DS9. I'm not going to do a countdown because that would be sad.
Maybe the last 10 episodes.
Maybe the last 10 episodes.
Or five.
Or five.
I don't know.
We're going to be talking about After Image and Take Me Out to the Holosuite.
Aw.
We'll see you then.